Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
Whether you're a fan of bourbon, scotch, tequila, rum, gin, whatever it is, VSLiquor.com has you covered. And here's the best part. Don't leave your home. VSLiquor.com is the most reliable alcohol delivery there is. Make sure to type in the code SPORTS when you check out, and you'll get 15% off your initial order. VSLiquor.com, proud partner of the Sliwa Show. All right, welcome back to the Sliwa Show. Evan Drellick covers baseball for The Athletic. Nice enough to join the show. Evan, what's going on, man? How are you doing?
Another day, another imminent proposal. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. Of course. I the timing is perfect. Okay, listen, maybe I'm the crazy one, but I feel like I know there's a lot of back and forth going on, but typically when there's a lot of back and forth going on, you have to just feel that eventually they're going to find some way to come to an agreement. How are you feeling just in general about the situation right now with baseball, Major League Baseball, and where we're sitting now?
Well, the commissioner at the draft tonight reiterated what had already become clear. There's going to be a season this year. It's just a question of how many games the season will end up being and how much acrimony they're going to have to get there and how much anger there's going to be on both sides once they do get there. The union last night made an offer for 89 games, and the league, Manfred said today, is formulating a counterproposal that the league thinks will move the ball further in the players' direction. They seem to be getting somewhere. It took a really long time to get here, and there's still no guarantee that they do work out a new deal. They can play without a new deal. We just have to see if they have an end game here that they can push through.
Evan, is there any idea of how many games Major League Baseball will come back with? And I know they've done this before, and you know, they obviously, there's certain structures, not just the amount of games, but how much the players will get paid. And I'm sure there's just a number of details that go into each one of these negotiations. But what do you think? What kind of number do you feel the owners and the commissioner are going to come back with?
Well, it is dependent on whether or not they're still asking for a pay cut, because the players are very firm that they're not going to move off of prorated salaries being paid in full on a per game basis. And the question then becomes, do the owners give in on that at this point? Because they haven't yet. In every proposal the owners have made, they've continued to ask for pay cuts, or do they make a request for a smaller pay cut? And would the players at that point consider it? You know, the players seem very firm that they will not. And so if indeed they will not consider a pay cut, then really the only question is how many games are owners willing to play at the full prorated salaries? And the league is basically threatened to play 50 or so games if no new deal is reached. And it's a lingering question. Well, would they want to play 60, 65 at full prorated salaries? One ownership source told me no today. So it's really a question of what do the owners come back with? Does it include pay cuts or not?
Hmm. Yeah, it seems like, Evan, I'll get your opinion on this. What is the however it gets figured out, But from a fan perspective, from a media perspective, what's the right amount of games to, you know, play out, obviously, start this season, eventually, hopefully finish this season, get into October with, you know, a postseason where you can then crown a World Series champion? I've played this, and I know you've done it as well. I've looked at, okay, well, what's the equivalent of 48 games in the NBA or in the NFL? It's obviously such a small sample size of games. What's a number that you think is a realistic and comfortable number that you feel, okay, they did the best as they can, and this is the best amount of games that we could play this season to give it some to make it as valid as possible?
I don't know where the line in the sand is between credible and not credible for a season. I do know that when you talk about 50 or so games versus 80 or so games, you can feel that difference, that 80 starts to feel better. I got to believe if they can keep it into the 70 range, people will still be pretty tolerant of it. And I'm actually of the opinion that regardless of the length of the season, people are going to be excited to have the sport back. But there will be some argument about the credibility of it. But in a way, the short answer is as many games as possible. And that's kind of the crux of the argument. In the March agreement, the players and the owners agreed to, it said that the league had to make its best efforts to schedule as many games as possible, but that goes back to this core economic question of, well, who's to say what's possible? If we say we can't afford it, who are you to say we can? So they all want as many games as they can get to, and 50 doesn't feel good. I think if you can keep it 70 or above, you're just in a better place selling the competitiveness of this season.
No, I'm with you. Evan Drellick covers baseball for The Athletic, joining the Sliwa Show. Evan, I think one question that can help, and I know you guys, you personally and many other of these great Major League Baseball, those who cover Major League Baseball, the economic factor of this and the amount of money that's being lost for owners each game played, that's kind of been one of the things that's been highlighted. Can you explain that for those that haven't got a chance? And you know, we don't know all the details. From an owner's perspective, what is their side of things when they say, look, because of the fact that we don't have 81 home games and that revenue coming in from fans and obviously the merchandising and so forth, what are some of these adjustments that they're making that has a, you know, obviously an effect every game they play hurts them rather than helps them?
Yeah, so the basic starting point is that the owners on average get about 40% of their revenues from gate related income. So that's tickets, merchandise, parking, food, anything basically related to somebody showing up at the ballpark. Once you get past that number, the owners are claiming that for every game played under the current agreement, which is full prorated salaries, they would lose money. That literally their business would be better off by not playing at full prorated salaries than by playing. That's why they're asking for a pay cut. That's their claim. The players don't agree with that assessment. The players have asked for the owners to open their books. The owners provided us some information, but not much, which is kind of to be expected. And part of the argument here has to do with the postseason, because the players will say, you're not counting the postseason money. And the owners will say, well, we're not sure we're going to get to the postseason because of the pandemic. And it is a fact that there is more money tied up in the postseason in the national media deals than there is in the regular season. It's about $780 million in the postseason compared to about $555 million in the regular season. That would be with an 82-game season. So it's a lot of talking past each other, but the very basic of it is the owners are saying we can't afford this. The players are saying we don't believe you can't afford this. And here we are.
Is it, Evan, when you talk about the postseason, and we've heard that emphasized a lot, yes, the postseason is where they make a great amount of money. But the issue or the fear is that, okay, if there's a second wave of the virus, then potentially they don't get that opportunity to play those games come October. Is this a conversation that is on the forefront? Because I'm just thinking about all the other sports, right? For the NBA, they would be done October 12th would be game seven. I don't need to tell you, you know, obviously the season for college football, NFL, it's going to be right in the heart of that. Is this a, you know, is it a big sticking point? And I say sticking point because there's no way of knowing what's going to happen in the next 3-4 months. And I'm sure, you know, owners and Major League Baseball are keeping this in mind, because if a bulk of their revenue comes during that month, they don't want to go past October. They're also fearful that even in October, maybe that's when the second wave is there. It could play a big part.
Yeah, and you're onto something, pointing out what the other sports are doing, because people can do that and say, well, those other sports are going to be playing in the fall, late into the fall and the winter. Why can't baseball do it? And it's not so much that baseball couldn't attempt to do it, it's that they've been advised, or at least they are taking the position that they're just better off not doing that, that the risk nonetheless increases. You know, those sports should be, they'd be playing when they would normally play, basically, whereas, you know, baseball would be pushing itself back. And then there is concern about broadcast rights and Fox and, you know, not going up against everything else if avoidable. So there are different factors at play there. And there is some skepticism that the owners don't want to play as many games as they're saying, as few games as they're saying, that in fact they would want more games. And there's some skepticism that they should have this hard line about November and pushing the season back. But the bottom line is, to this point, the owners have made their stance clear. They do not want to push the World Series back. And until further notice, we have to take them at their word on that one.
Evan Drella covers baseball for The Athletic, joining the Sliwa Show. Evan, you know, walking into this season, I think it was clear two favorites, one in the NL, one in the AL, and it's the Dodgers and the Yankees that were going to be the two teams that were pretty much going to be the class of Major League Baseball. So sitting here in Los Angeles, just your thoughts on if we get baseball back, how do you think this will have an effect? Shortened season, I know we're talking, it could be as short as 48 games, maybe at the most, it seems like at this point, 80 games. Let's just use that as an example. How do you think that affects the Dodgers? Of course, the sample size, the bigger the sample size, the more it's going to credit the best team or the best roster, or the most talented roster and bullpen and everything else. But how do you think it will specifically affect the Dodgers?
Well, it's really a roll of the dice when you have that few games. You know, we talk about playoffs being something of a crapshoot. You're hitting the nail on the head. When you take away the length of the season, it really comes down to who's getting hot. And teams that in 162 games would not contend probably will contend if you're playing as few as 50 games. And as many games as you can move it up from there, you know, 60, 70, or even in the 80-game range, that should benefit the Dodgers. So if you're a Dodgers fan, what you probably should be rooting for is as many games as possible, because that's the way that the true talent can shine through, rather than the hot start and good fortune elements.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to put it. And I know, look, there's so many questions still being asked, and it's tough to even try and break down the chances of a team, you know, making the postseason and having a run at the World Series when we're not there yet, right? You know, hopefully in the next week or 2 weeks, that's what most of the conversation shifts. But Evan, it's great information. I know there's, from a content perspective, there's a lot of listeners out there that, you know, we all have questions and we're trying to get as many of them answered. So for you to take some time and break that all down for us, it's greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's Evan Drellick right there. Great stuff, and hopefully as I continue to bring guests on to talk baseball, we're actually going to be talking baseball in the near future and not whether the game's going to be played, how many games are going to be played. Adrian Wojnarowski, if you didn't see some of his tweets from earlier, some concerns from some of the players, he was also on SportsCenter. I'll explain what I'm talking about coming up next. Stay right here. This is the Sliwa Show on 710 ESPN. 710 ESPN wants to salute all of our frontline workers as part of our Thank You Thursdays presented by Valvoline Instant Oil Change. If you know someone who is working as a healthcare provider, firefighter, EMS worker, or a food service professional, nominate him or her today. Here's how you do it. Email the station, ESPNLAMarketing@ESPN.com, with their first and last name, city, and occupation, or post a short video on Instagram or Twitter and include the hashtag 710 Thank You Thursdays. Every Thursday, we'll interview a frontline worker. We'll award them a $500 thank you gift to include a $200 service to Valvoline Instant Oil Change, $100 gift card to Wingstop, VSLiquor.com, and Shooteria.com. So thank you to our partners, and thank you to our frontline workers. Woj was on SportsCenter a little bit earlier today, and he was sending out some tweets. So, you know, I spent a lot of time over these last, you know, this last month or so, and this is a mistake on my part, is you're looking at the lens through you know, your own personal perspective, you're looking at the lens through a sports perspective, and you're just saying, let's just get sports back, right? I'm assuming health officials and I'm assuming players and the NBA, they're going to figure out, you know, from all the testing perspective, everyone will feel comfortable when it's all said and done. That's obviously very naive. But Woj talked about earlier today on SportsCenter how some of the players are worried about how restricted they're going to be in this bubble.
You know, I think a lot in the last week, 10 days, I think it's really started to hit it home with a lot of players and coaches and members of organizations of how isolating, how restrictive this bubble environment is going to be. And there are a number of players. I was told a few dozen who have been talking. They had at least one conference call to kind of hash out some thoughts among each other. And listen, for a lot of players, there are family concerns. There are certainly concerns about COVID. There are concerns about a number of issues built around having to go inside that bubble, you know, many of them for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 2.5, 3 months, especially, Kevin, you hear it more and more among the teams who know or certainly believe they're not really going there to compete to win a championship.
All right, it's a fair concern. It's a legitimate concern. I think there's a simple solution to this. If you're not comfortable going back to work, you can't be forced to go. And I think the NBA understands that. Now, how is it all going to play out? What, you know, players will not go. I don't think fans are necessarily going to be upset. And even if they are, it's, you know, it's too bad if a player just doesn't feel comfortable or there's a family concern. It is what it is. But I will say this. I think it does kind of make things a little bit more complicated. And we should know that, okay, this isn't going to be a clear path to the NBA Finals. This isn't going to be this is definitely not going to be a road that doesn't get rocky at some times, that they don't have to go left when they thought they were supposed to go right, when, you know, hurdles come up. That's going to happen in the NBA. That's going to happen with all sports. It's going to happen with every business that tries to go back to work in this COVID-19 world. Woj also on SportsCenter. What if someone is unsure about playing in the bubble?
I think that, you know, teams right now, you know, for the most part, you know, they have not gotten direct word, especially from key players, that they're not going or don't want to play. And I think a lot of these players who are talking, Kevin, many of them may decide to still go in and play. But there's sort of a moment of truth here as the league and the union are just finishing up the details. They're getting ready to announce all the protocols that are going to go into this return in Orlando. You know, I think for players, they understand this is a moment in time where they've got to talk this out and make a decision for themselves, certainly, about what might make best sense for them individually, for their families.
That's obviously, I feel like when Woj mentioned a little bit earlier in that in the clip prior to this one about teams that don't think they have a chance, players that are on teams that think they don't have a chance to actually really compete for a championship, maybe it affects more of those teams, but we'll see. One thing I will tell you over the last few months is nothing is, you know, a surprise anymore. Everything that you thought, kind of, this is going to happen, or that's going to happen, or this will play out this way, or that will play out that way. That hasn't been the case. So we'll see what eventually happens with the NBA, but there are some players that are worried about how restricted this this bubble is going to be. Curtis, halftime's coming up next, Curtis. Something you want to tease? Just feel free, Curtis. Whatever it is that you want to tease.
I have something that really triggered me regarding an athlete and a reopening. A new reopening that Jesse will be excited about, and I'm sure others will too.
That's my man right there. Look at Curtis. Look at Curtis making it happen. All right, halftime coming up next. Stay right here. This is the Sliwa Show on 710 ESPN.
GEICO knows there are many reasons why you ride. From the camaraderie of the other bikers, a band of brothers, always there for you, rain or shine, to the amazing savings you get with GEICO on your motorcycle insurance and accessories coverage all year round. But for Bucky Hornhill, it was one reason in particular.
It was my helmet hair. I was born with helmet hair. I've tried to cut it a bunch of times, even buzzing it, but it immediately just goes back to helmet hair.
GEICO Motorcycle. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
I'm not crazy. I think it's all going to work out. I think we're going to get baseball back, Jess, and I think we're going to get the right amount of games. I'm gonna go 70. I'm gonna go 70 games. That's what my prediction is gonna be.
Alan, I hope games. You're right. I'm not that high. I think we're gonna get somewhere between 60 and maybe 50. I'm on the lower side, but I think no matter what,
but that's like is God,
coming back.
Dang it! I mean, that's too little. It's just too little. Doesn't that feel like if it's around the 75 game mark, what it really feels great at is 80. But that's not going to happen.
Yeah. 80 would have been perfect.
80 feels really good. 70, you're like, okay, we're good. Let's get to work. Let's get started. We'll see. I mean, this has been a reoccurring conversation for 30 days, and I was not a fan of Manfred, who basically said on SportsCenter, owners are listening to fans and players. Come on. No, you're not. No, you're not. Let's stop pretending like don't BS the fans out there that you're listening. If you're listening, this would have been done 30 days ago. So they're obviously that's all talk. Talk is cheap.
Yeah, I think that's what he meant. He meant they're listening. They are listening, but you know they're just not
paying attention.
Doing anything about it. Yeah,
not doing anything about it.
They're like, thank you, random citizen.
Yeah, and that should do it. Curtis, why don't you get things started, buddy? By the way, not a bad tease for me. Just completely out of nowhere, just saying, why don't you tease what we got coming up? So, good work on that. What do you have?
I excel on the last second BSing. It's like a skill.
Yeah, it's definitely
a good skill to have.
I do it from 6:30 to 8:57.
I wanted to just let that marinate a little bit.
That's it. Nothing, Curtis.
No, go ahead, bud. Just let you finish your point. Mm-hmm. All right. 65 years to the day on July 17th. Disneyland and California Adventure will be reopening.
Oh, boy.
Say the date again. Say the date.
July 17th, which is...
July 17th.
Yeah, that was the date that the park opened the first time ever. So, clearly this was mm-hmm. planned. They had this figured out to a T. I know Jess loves Disneyland. I don't know your take on Disneyland, Alan. I don't think we ever talked about it. But the park will use... They're going to use a reservation system. So it's going to be, I don't know what capacity they're going to do. They haven't really announced it yet, but no fireworks, no parades, nothing that gathers large groups of people. So is this too soon?
So let me say, you asked what my kind of view is on Disneyland. So Disneyland for me, you know, I've been at the station now for over 10 years. So we have that pass to, for listeners who don't know, if you're, you know, Disney employee, you have this pass that you can use, Silver Pass, I think is what it's called. Go down to Disneyland or California Adventure. If it's not one of these blackout dates, you can go and you can take up to three people with you. So for me, it's like a business transaction. That's pretty much all Disneyland has been. What I mean by that is I've had either friends or family or clients that have asked if I can get them into Disneyland. So typically I like go, get them in, hang out for, you know, as much as long as I can, just based upon what the work schedule is like, and then, you know, move on from there. The one thing that I will say is the times I've gone to Disneyland and it was just no rush, just take your time, not worry about anything, Disneyland's great. But going in the middle of summer and the weather's hot, that I can't do. Weather's got to be right, or that's a tough part.
Especially the last 2 days where it's been like near 100 every day.
I hate these last 2 days. It's been way too hot.
And you said July 17th. You know, that's the middle. just think about what the weather is going to be like, the heart of just the heart of summer. Is it too soon? I think at some point, you know, they're going to slowly ease it back in. Weren't you telling me, Jess, we were talking earlier, you were saying a NASCAR event coming up, that there was actually a place where they're going to allow 5,000 fans in.
Yeah, in Talladega Super Speedway in Alabama.
So I guess you got to start trying in some capacity. So I just use that as an example. It's not like they're bringing in 80,000 people at once at NASCAR. It's not like Disneyland California Adventure are going to, you know, walk in and say, okay, let's go back to full capacity. I'm sure there's going to be crazy amount of restrictions and probably an incredibly smaller percentage of what they're, you know, accustomed to.
Yeah, and just talking about that NASCAR event, Talladega Speedway, Super Speedway, that racetrack, the capacity, depending on configuration, is between 80,000 to 175,000, and they're maxing it out at 5,000. So, you know, the capacity for Disneyland, I believe is around like 30,000 plus. I'm pretty sure they're going to cap it at the max I see is like 10. Maybe.
Well, I was going to say it's going to be based on probably percentage. So if it's 30,000, I wouldn't be surprised if 5,000 people are in there, which, by the way, is a great time to go. I mean, you know, I don't know how they're going to do it, how they're going to coordinate it, but imagine if 20% or 15% or even 10% of what is capacity at Disneyland is what is allowed in. Like, that's kind of an opportunity to go on as many rides as you possibly can. So that, I don't think it's too soon. I just think they're going to take their time and be very strategic with how they open it.
Capacity is about 85,000 counting Downtown Disney, California Adventure, and the resort. So obviously they won't do a full thing and they haven't announced what, but it's a big chunk.
Yeah, I think
they gotta do something at some point, you know?
And it's going to, you know, they're making this move, and obviously they got approved by the government and everything. So they're basically saying, hey, we're open if you want to come. But if not, then, you know, you wait. Like, I'm going to wait and see, just because I don't feel super safe going back to a theme park just yet. But I'm definitely excited just to see how it's going to be, because it's going to be something completely different.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Wouldn't you guys both agree that if 85,000 is capacity, and let's say they're doing something where it's a percentage, 10%, 20%, I think it's going to be freaking packed. Like, when I say packed, as in whatever that capacity is, they're going to reach it. And for the next God knows how long, they're going to continue to reach that capacity for a number of reasons. Number one, I think there's people that just want to get out of their house. I think, you know, families that are out there that are just – they can't wait to get, you know, obviously just take their kids out and do something with them. I think it's going to be a combination of all that. I wouldn't be surprised that whatever that cap is, they're going to hit that cap every day for as long as they're open for under those restrictions.
I think so too. I think that Disney brand, Disney Magic, holds very strong connections, very strong ties to a lot of people, including me. But I think there's no way that people aren't excited to go back and are going to jump at that opportunity.
Jess, what do you got, buddy?
All right. So, kind of in similar fashion, there was some other off-site news leading up to this. Coachella and Stagecoach was officially canceled today. Sad news, but, you know.
Were they supposed to go in October?
They were. Yeah, they were originally got rescheduled to October. And, you know, I held my hopes up, but, you know, ultimately I knew it probably wasn't going to happen. And today it was official. They canceled it. However, there is something to look forward to. San Diego Comic-Con is usually in, the summertime around July.
Yeah.
Ironically enough, around the time Disneyland's opening. And a lot of people thought that they were going to cancel their – actually, I don't remember if it got actually canceled, if they confirmed that it was canceled. But it was announced this afternoon that they're going to do Comic-Con from home. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have promising panels, a presentation of comic books, gaming, television, films, and a wide variety of topics, publishers, studios, and more. All from, you know, the comfort of your home. So I think that's, you know, something that's really cool that they're going to do, because it opens up an opportunity for people who haven't been to Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. So I've been to several cons before. Alan, have you ever been to any kind of convention before?
You mean like Comic-Con?
Any kind. Different.
Yeah.
I mean, there's different kinds. Like, I've been to a Lakers kind of convention before.
You're an anime expo kind of guy, Alan.
Yeah, big time. Big time. Auto show I've been. You know,
a good annual
auto show convention here in LA. I've been to the one down in San Diego. What other conventions have I been to? I can't name. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. But I will say this. Comic-Con, which I know how popular it is, and me being from San Diego, it's interesting because as big and as popular as it was, I think for a lot of residents during Comic-Con, you kind of stay away from downtown, right? Because it's just such a zoo, you know? Such a zoo, so many people there. But back in the days when I was working at the old sports radio station down in San Diego, we carried the Padres broadcast. So you'd be down there for a game in downtown because, you know, Padres had their, you know, a game.
The and Petco
Comic-Con
Park.
Would be going on at Petco. Comic-Con would be going on at the same time. Bro, what a trip. I mean, it just took over downtown San Diego, and everywhere you looked, it was just like for me, I don't understand it, like, because I just don't know enough about it. But of course, all the gear that they're wearing, the costumes, it's quite a show, man. It just was never something that I fully understood or got into.
Yeah, it definitely hits on the fandom. I mean, it's only grown ever for the past couple of years. Now it's like this humongous event, and it's actually that's how like the con part of convention became like a big thing. You know, like there's WrestleCon for whenever WrestleMania is around. You know, there's the Anime Con, as Curtis mentioned. There's like so many niche cons. Like I remember back in like 2008 or 2009. It wasn't like a Lakers con, but the Lakers had an event at the convention center where they had, you know, a couple of Lakers sponsors, like Toyota was there and a couple of other sponsors at the time. But they had, you know, three of their trophies were there. They had Laker girls. I didn't meet Derek Fisher, but he was like a speaker there. And then, you know, what else? Who else was there? I think Shannon Brown was there. So there was stuff like that. And it kind of spawned. You can find a convention for almost anything. Like there's a Lord of the Rings convention that I remember I once randomly stumbled upon Tongu, and I thought that was funny. My girlfriend wants to do it. She's a big Lord of the Rings fan. But you can, if there's a big enough like community, that there's likely a con. It might be small, but there's going to be likely a con for it.
No, there is, and I know LA's got a number of different ones. I just haven't been to a number of them. Okay, so I don't know if you guys saw this. We talked about this a while back. So former head coach Brian Shaw, obviously former Laker as well, he's going to lead this NBA G League select team. You guys remember this was a few months back where we were talking about the number one high school recruit is actually going to be joining this NBA G League. We talked about – I'll just list off some of the players. So Jalen Green, Isaiah Todd, Deshaun Nix, Kay Soto. So a lot of these players are top 25, some of them top 10, decided to forego college basketball, go straight from the from high school to this G League, this NBA G League that they're having, which is not going to actually – it's a G League team. It's not going to be affiliated. It is affiliated, but they're not going to actually take on – you know, they're not going to face other G League teams or anything like that. They'll get a chance to make money. And Brian Shaw is not going to be the coach. So I think what they're really, really trying to do is legitimize this thing. They want to make it, you know, a real farm system. And they're trying to pay the players, or they're trying to pay these high school athletes who are going to become, you know, obviously a part of this G League. They're going to try and make it a real farm system for the NBA. I think them adding Brian Shaw, who's got tremendous amount of experience, you know, as a player, we know the Lakers, he ended up winning 5 NBA championships, you know, in his career. He has 30 years of experience as an NBA player and a coach. So he's a very, very knowledgeable, respected former coach, former player in the NBA. NBA is making moves to make this G League something that, you know, will really compete for college basketball. And this is just another step taking towards that direction.
It sounds like you know how a lot of the football teams on the other side of the globe here have the academies? You know, they pick out players when they're really young and train them. And that's where the stars come from. So if the NBA can legitimize it, I mean, I think that's good. I mean, if you can get another AC Fresh out of there, I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. It's not just going to be those type of players, the Carusos that are in the G League, sign a two-way and then go. I mean, think about this. One of the things that happened in Major League Baseball is the farm system right now is obviously the minor league system is really being affected by all the adjustments that the league has to make with COVID-19. The difference with the minor league system for baseball and the G League for the NBA, every star you see playing Major League Baseball, they're in the minor league system. Like that's your minor league system is your future. That's every player that you see right now that's having success in Major League Baseball, you know, obviously spent time in the minor leagues. I think that's what the NBA is trying to do. If they can create a league where you get paid, you get some money, and you're not just this two-way player that was undrafted and, you know, you are trying, like a journeyman trying to make it in the league, they're trying to get legitimate stars that would be legitimate stars in college to be a part of this G League program, I think they're going to do it. They got the number one recruit in the country. I think they grabbed number 5, number 11. Like, they grabbed some big recruits that didn't go to college, chose the G League.
If they can groom one superstar, I think it's worth it, right? If you get one, not even LeBron caliber, but a superstar out of this program, don't you think that's a good sign already?
Yeah, if you got, let's say, a Paul George quality player, right? Or a Bradley Beal, or, I mean, just I'm naming off players that are all-stars. They're really, really good. And if they didn't go to high school and all of a sudden they feel like, man, we're more prepared, we're better prepared, and we get paid, and then we end up in the NBA, it sounds like that's a path that's going to be attractive to a lot of these younger players.
Yeah, I mean, what you got players, you know, like Patrick Beverley, you're not even thinking about stars. That league just produces, you know, a solid bench player. It's good enough and it's worth it, because not only are you paying for your future, you're investing in your future. You're saying like, hey, if the lowest ceiling you can hit is a solid bench player by going to this league, I'm all for it. I would much rather do that, because not only, you know, they're getting paid, you're in the league. You have your foot in the door. In college basketball, you're not really allowed to have your foot in the door, and you know you'd have to deal with the NCAA and all this. With the G League, you're in the NBA. You're a part of what you're working towards. So even if you know you don't have the best of season in the G League, you know what? There might be a coach that saw something in that and be like, you know what? He played with this group. He liked that. I'm picking it in. Where if you're at, you know, some, let's say Davidson, where Steph Curry came from. I don't know any other player that came from Davidson. But if you're Davidson, you're not going to stand out as much because you went to there, you know, a no-name school. If you just take a chance on yourself, and you know what, you take a chance on yourself and you're getting paid for it, I would much rather do that, because you know what, at the end of the day, I got paid and I can choose from either try again, try harder, keep going, or be like, you know what, maybe this doesn't work out. I'm gonna find what else I'm going to do.
But this is where it's different, Jess. Jalen Green, that's one of the players that's going to be a part of this G League, you know, academy, I guess, if you want to call it. You know what he's currently projected to go in the 2021 draft?
Top 10.
He's projected to go number 2. So
within top 10.
I'm saying that because
is Melo one?
I'm saying that because KD was, I think, a number 2 pick, right?
After Greg Oden and then KD.
Brandon Ingram's number 2. I'm just kind of spitballing off the top of my head the different number 2 picks. Dwayne Wade was a top 5 pick. They're not going for journeymen. They're going for big hitters. You know what I mean? Like they're trying to crop not just role players. They're trying to crop superstars or players that could be all-stars. So I think that's where it's a little different. All right, Curtis, yeah. You got another one?
If we got time, it kind of triggered me. Like I kind of got a little shook when I saw this. If you guys want to do it,
what do you got?
All right,
what shook at you, Curtis?
I saw this last night. You guys know my history as a former Tampa Bay Buccaneer fan. As we were wrapping up here, I saw this roll on the ticker. Jameis Winston said to Bleacher Report that he thinks he's one of the best quarterbacks in history. I was immediately shaken. But Pat McAfee on his podcast actually summarized it much better. So I'm going to let him summarize it for us.
And if I'm Jameis Winston, the reason why I'm thinking that is because I only have people around me that show me one stat and one stat alone. And that is Jameis Winston ranks 8th overall in the history Wow. of the game for most pass yards in one NFL season. What do quarterbacks do in the NFL? They throw the ball. That is their job. And if I'm Jameis Winston, number 8 in the history of the game season belongs to me. If I'm Jameis Winston, I'm saying this, that's because I looked at that stat. Then there's this other stat. It's also to make sure that you don't also give the same exact chance to the other team to win the game when it comes to turnovers, because he ranks 7th in the NFL when it comes to turnovers. 30 interceptions, I mean. The only thing that brings him down is his decision making whenever he has the football and he throws it to the other team.
Well, Curtis, by the way, that's a great setup right there. And McAfee does a great show.
Love Pat McAfee.
Yeah, pretty sure you have to be smart with, you know, as a quarterback with the decisions that you're making. He's the first NFL quarterback in league history to throw for at least 30 touchdowns and 30 interceptions in the same season. He's 28-42 over five seasons as a starter. He's, you know, taking a 1-year option right now with New Orleans as a backup. So he can think he is one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, but, you know, you could be a pitcher in baseball and throw 99, 100, 102. That's all great. But if you have no control for every, you know, for every strikeout that you get, if you're giving up a walk, it's eventually, you're eventually going to have a losing record and your team's going to be in trouble. And that's kind of in a sense, in my opinion, that's kind of Jameis Winston in a nutshell.
Just didn't like the look. The look of, okay, you ran through three offensive head coaches that were hired to help you. You burn the bridges there, and you're backing up on your team's rival now behind Drew Brees. It's just it wasn't a great look, and I'm just not a huge fan of all the decisions he made. His decision was kind of – picking him was the last straw for me as a Bucks fan, and I've been gone ever since.
You want to know what's even more funny, though?
What's that?
I don't think he's backing up Drew Brees. I think he's Taysom Hill's backup.
Oh, yeah, that's even
you
better.
You might be right about that. You might be right about that.
I think that's the cherry on top of all this, is he's not even really Brees' backup. He's Taysom Hill's backup.
By the way, let me go back to this. I want to see him succeed. Like, I have no reason to, you know, listen, I feel for a quarterback like that. He's trying to make it happen. He's trying to make it work. This is a situation. What he signed for, I think, only $1 million with New Orleans. So he's obviously just trying to get an opportunity, any opportunity that he can get. Cam Newton still hasn't signed anywhere. So he's going to try and, you know, make things happen, look long term, but definitely no need to pump yourself up that high at a time where it's just unnecessary. I mean, he's got a lot to – I think he's – the more humble he is, probably the better look for him to say he's one of the greatest of all time. Probably not many people are going to buy into that.
I think the one thing we will always know that Jameis Winston has is confidence, because you got to be – you got to have – great amount of confidence in yourself to speak up like that. Because I thought a 30-30 season was only possible in Madden. But Jameis Winston, you proved me wrong.
He made it happen. Hey. He made it happen. The dog agrees.
Charlie agrees too.
And while we were talking, Charlie, he just threw three more interceptions.
He just threw three more.
Yep.
Once to Charlie, that's why he's barking. He's excited.
Fellas, we have some good news here. Soccer columnist for ESPN, Jeff Carlisle, is going to be coming.
LAFC,
and what's he going to be talking about? We got some Major League Soccer that's coming back. So news today on Major League Soccer returning on July 8th. We got all the details coming up with Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN. He'll give us some information on that. Plus, Jess, what happens after, right? The regular season. They are going to have a regular season after, and they'll play out the remainder of the regular season. So he'll give us all those details. So do that coming up next. Stay right here. Sliwa Show, 710 ESPN. Welcome back to the Sliwa Show. I want to welcome in Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN. Jeff, we got some good news on the soccer front. We're hoping for some good baseball news as we continue, but it's a good day for Major League Soccer. Thank you for taking the time to join the show.
Yeah, no problem, and absolutely, it's a very good day. It's been a very good week, I would say, for Major League Soccer. I mean, last week we had, you know, some labor peace achieved with a new collective bargaining agreement that was ratified. You know, that was pretty tense at times between MLS and the MLS Players Association. Still, you know, some bitter feelings, I suspect, amongst the rank and file, just in terms of how those negotiations went. But certainly a happier topic today, you know, with MLS's announcement that, you know, about the particulars on the tournament that they're going to hold in Orlando. You know, all 26 teams, you know, kind of almost like a World Cup style tournament. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how things like, you know, testing and, you know, keeping guys in the bubble for upwards of 6 weeks. I mean, we'll see if that holds. But, you know, certainly it's a big step forward for the league, you know, just given the fact that it's been shut down for almost 3 months.
Jeff, can you give us, you've got a great article right now on ESPN.com that just kind of details what the tournament's going to look like, how long it goes, how many games, the least amount of games you could play, the most amount. for those that haven't got a chance to read it or have not been on ESPN today and got the full details, can you kind of break down what this MLS is Back tournament is going to look like and, you know, obviously what it means as far as the layout for all the teams?
Yeah, it's going to be six groups. They had to, you know, kind of massage the conferences a little bit. I mean, Nashville SC started the year in the Western Conference, which seems a little odd geographically, but they're going to move to the Eastern Conference, not only for this tournament, but I believe for the rest of the season. And so there's going to be three Western Conference groups, you know, three groups of four. There's going to be three groups in the East as well, but there's going to be one kind of unbalanced. It's going to have six teams. You know, there's six seeded teams. You know, Orlando City is one of the hosts, or actually as the host, is going to be seeded. Then you've got LAFC, you know, Seattle Sounders, Real Salt Lake, and then you've got Atlanta United and Toronto FC. So, you know, those six teams are going to be seeded. There's going to be a three-game group stage and followed by a knockout round. Everything's going to get started on July 8th. And, you know, it's kind of a twist is that, you know, only the group stage games are going to count in the standings. So, you know, each team's going to get three games in. And then you're wondering, well, why actually go to a knockout stage? Well, you know, the league has sweetened the pot, literally. There's a $1.1 million purse attached to the knockout rounds. And the winner of the tournament gets a spot in the CONCACAF Champions League. So, you know, there is a bit of meaning, and I think the league was really intent on having a real competitive aspect to this. You know, I think they were worried about, you know, just everything kind of going through the motions, especially without fans being present. And then some other good news is that Don Garber seems to think that once this tournament is over, August 11th, the teams will by then be able to go back to their home markets and start having games. Most likely those will be without fans, but Garber is entertaining the possibility that at some point fans will be able to attend games. So we'll see how things go with the pandemic. You know, there's been obviously lots of ups and downs with that. You know, some cities starting to loosen restrictions, but we still got some hot spots in the country. So it's going to be something to keep an eye on, certainly as things move further into the year.
Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN, joining the Sliwa Show. Jeff, by the way, great perks. Like you mentioned, this isn't, you know, you don't want to have some kind of a tournament. You just run through the motions. You're doing it just to, you know, see if you can garner some money, play some games. Those are great perks. And I'll ask you, I think one of the questions comes down to how unique is this tournament? I mean, was this always the idea that they'll have a tournament and then eventually try and get back to the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the beginning, MLS was trying to do something unique. You know, they wanted to, you know, basically find a way to compensate for the fact that the fans weren't going to be around. I think the idea of having a tournament was always in the cards. I think the length of it was an issue for the players. I mean, originally, MLS had planned on having all the teams show up in early June, you know, right about now, actually. And then they would be in Orlando for 10 weeks. And I can tell you, as someone who's covered a World Cup, and usually those last 5 to 6 weeks, by the end, you are ready to go home. And so, you know, to have it be 10 weeks at one point, that was something that the players pushed back on. And the league listened. And I think it also helped, again, that, you know, some cities are relaxing their restrictions in terms of, you know, shelter in place or stay-at-home orders or whatever they're calling it. So, but yeah, the plan was always to have a tournament. You know, it was originally, I think it was going to be five group stage games. And so, I mean, the idea for this tournament has gone through a lot of iterations, but I think both the league and the players hit upon a solution that, you know, definitely found a middle ground in terms of the duration and how many games are actually going to get played.
Jeff, you mentioned this, that, okay, once this tournament ends, the idea and the concept is they'll plan to go back to their regular season. Are there any details of what that looks like, how the schedule is going to look when they do come back, or is that something that's coming in the, you know, in the next couple of weeks or so?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard some broad strokes. I mean, I've heard that the league wants to get about another 18 games in, and so when you add in the two games that, you know, they played back in March or late February, plus these three games, that'll get you to 23 games, which is about two-thirds of a season. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, I'd say that's a big enough sample size to, you know, to kind of go forward and move on into the playoffs. And then, you know, from what I've heard, they're going to hopefully have MLS Cup sometime in mid-December. Mm-hmm. But again, this is a really fluid situation, not only with the pandemic, but you've got international windows that you're contending with. Are those actually going to take place? Certainly there's a September window that the CONCACAF president, Victor Montagliani, said was probably not going to happen. So that might open up some additional dates, you know, not only for the regular season, but also for the playoffs that, that are going to come in October and November and December. So, but again, it's such a fluid situation, and, you know, we'll see if the leagues are at, you know, the MLS is actually able to go forward with this. I mean, there's been some talk of starting in August. You know, maybe they wait a month and start in September to make sure that all of the teams kind of have are operating on a level playing field, because one of the interesting things that's been happening over the last 2 weeks is some teams have been able to engage in practice at their training facilities.
That's right.
Others haven't. I mean, the San Jose Earthquakes just started yesterday. So so obviously it's not a an even situation in terms of teams' preparation and kind of where they're at with their fitness and everything. So I think that's another consideration that the league is going to have to consider.
Nice to have Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN, joining the Sliwa Show. Jeff, you know, when you kind of the way you point things out as far as some of the different dates, I'm just going to make this comparison, and you know, you could give me your thoughts on it. One of the concerns baseball has of playing past October is, you know, health officials have said there is fear of a second wave coming in for COVID-19 or the coronavirus. How much does that come into play with how soccer is structuring their season, number one? And number two, is this kind of one of those things I've proposed this question to a lot of different NBA, some of the NBA reporters or those that are close to others and, you know, within front offices. Is the plan that's there just the plan, but the reality is nobody has any idea if they're going to be able to execute it as is, simply because, you know, we're all kind of walking blind right now, and there's going to be some trial and error. There's going to be more data that comes out, and we could be sitting here 30, 60 days from now, and what we thought was one thing is completely different.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely concern about a second wave, and I think that's why you've heard so much, you know, so many iterations of this plan, so many versions of it, and so yeah, I mean, I think that the second wave is definitely a concern. I mean, and you know, they talk about it coming back, you know, strong in the winter, and that's, you know, that's really the business end of the season. I mean, the playoffs typically start in October, go into November. I mean, last year, that's when the season ended, but in years prior to that, the MLS championship was held, you know, second weekend in December. So I think that's very much a concern. And, you know, the league has had to be nimble so far, and I think they're going to continue to kind of adopt that attitude. In terms of execution of the plan, you know, for sure. I mean, I think MLS is reasonably safe in terms of this tournament. And you know, we're really only looking a couple months into the future. Now, granted, a ton can change, but you know, I think MLS feels pretty good about the plans that they've put down. I mean, they're only talking about one venue. Everything's going to be in Orlando. So now, after that, obviously, it gets a lot more complicated. You know, especially, you know, like I said earlier, teams going into their own markets and trying to host games, and you know, now there's travel. You know, teams are traveling every week. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously that increases the risk of exposure to COVID-19. So I think you're absolutely right to be concerned and think that things might change. They probably will. But I think a league like MLS also has to deal with the realities in front of it. And right now, I think they feel pretty good about the plans that they've put down, the tournament they've put together, and how it's going to go forward.
Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN, taking some time and joining the Sliwa Show. Jeff, how is the Bundesliga league going? And what I'm referring to there, just looking at it from a health perspective, has there been, you know, many cases of players that have tested positive for COVID-19? Can we is there something that we could take from the German league starting up that, you know, Major League Soccer can use as well? Is there information coming out from that league that is helpful?
Yeah, I think just in terms of how game days are handled, you know, I think MLS definitely took a page out of the Bundesliga's book in terms of, like, essential personnel that need to be in the stadium. Obviously, it'll be a pretty controlled environment in Orlando at the ESPN Wide World of Sports complex. And, you know, certainly in terms of the broadcast, I mean, I think the Bundesliga has done some unique things, you know, with piping in the crowd noise. Now, personally, I'm not a fan of that. But
I'm with you.
You know, it's gotten
I'm
some positive reviews
one.
From others. So, I mean, it's, I think it's a matter of taste when it comes to that. But I think it does speak to how creative leagues are trying to be and how, you're right, a bunch of, you know, leagues, not even soccer leagues, are watching what the Bundesliga does in terms of kind of adapting to this new situation where they're playing games without fans. So, you know, the testing protocols, you know, how they're handling the game day, I think MLS has definitely taken some pages out of the Bundesliga's book. And I can't remember too many recent positive tests. I mean, I think almost the most noteworthy thing was when a coach kind of broke the quarantine because he needed toothpaste or something. So, and that's actually going to be something to watch in Orlando. I mean, these guys are going to be in a bubble, and while, well, Disney World's got tons of golf courses and restaurants and whatnot, you know, all it takes is one guy to kind of go stir crazy and break the bubble and, you know, decide he needs to get the heck out of there. And then it'll be interesting to see how the league actually reacts to that. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, the Bundesliga has definitely been a model for soccer leagues all over the world.
How about just injuries in general? I know one of the concerns, we talk about it a lot for an NBA perspective out here in Los Angeles. Obviously, you know, we're hitting on all the local teams, Lakers, Clippers. But just from a soccer perspective for LAFC and the Galaxy, does the Bundesliga, how about injuries as in players that, you know, were prepped, they were ready, got the season started, then all of a sudden everything halted. Now you're trying to get that engine back up and running. Is there concerns on that front? Have there been issues in the German league when it comes to injuries?
Well, I think I have to give credit to some of the powers that be. There's a body called the International Football Association Board, which kind of is the rulemaking body of the game of soccer worldwide. And they were preemptive in terms of, you know, usually you have three substitutes, no free substitution. Once you're out, you're out. They expanded that to five. And so I think that's something that has kind of helped mitigate any, you know, most of the issues surrounding injuries. I mean, yes, there have been injuries, and certainly that was a concern of the MLS Players Association, was that, you know, like you mentioned, they started the season, then it was stopped. I mean, granted, they've been doing everything they can to maintain their fitness, but, you know, it's not the same as, you know, being out on the practice field every day with your teammates. So we'll see how much the five sub rule actually helps players stay healthy. And you're going to have to see teams dig deep into their benches. I mean, I think that's just a reality. You know, especially with the rapidity with which these games are going to come. You know, I think it's a little more spread out than what was initially proposed, but you know, certainly it's, you know, teams and players are going to have to get into a rhythm again of playing, recovering, training, and then starting again. So, but again, I think the hope is that the five sub rule will go a long way towards limiting injuries.
Jeff, great stuff, man. You know, it's I know we've got a chance to spend some time and just kind of take a listen and read some of the articles. Your article on ESPN.com breaks it down perfectly. Major League Soccer is back, and Jeff Carlisle, nice enough to join the Sleeve Show to break it all down. Appreciate it, Jeff. Have a great rest of your day, all right?
All right, anytime.
All right, that's Jeff Carlisle right there. Okay, I want to do this when we come back. I don't know if you guys got a chance to listen at all to Torrey Hunter. Obviously, former baseball player, played 19 years in the majors, played, I think, 5 years with the Angels. Torrey Hunter was talking about just racism, his experience with racism. He's obviously talking about Major League Baseball, but had something specific about a specific team and his experiences playing every time he was on the road. I think that part's interesting. I think what's even more interesting is how that team responded on Twitter. We'll talk about that coming up next. Stay right here. This is the Sliwa Show on 710 ESPN.
Reggie Bush right out the middle, gets the outside. He's at the 30. It's another foot race. Cuts it back to the 20. Comes back to the near side of the field. He is going to go. It's going to be another USC touchdown and another thing of beauty from one of the best running backs you will ever see.
That's the Reggie Bush clip we were looking for. Reggie Bush, obviously, we talked about it a little bit earlier. The 10-year probation now lifted for Reggie Bush. You can take part at, you know, obviously events and basically anything he needs to do at USC. He doesn't have to worry about that anymore. Program, he's part of the, can rejoin the program at USC. All right, 710 ESPN wants to salute all of our frontline workers as part of our Thank You Thursdays presented by Valvoline Instant Oil Change. If you know someone who is working as a healthcare provider, a firefighter, an EMS worker, or a food service professional, nominate him or her today. Here's how you do it. Email the station at ESPNLAMarketing@ESPN.com with your first and last name, the city, and the occupation, or post a short video on Instagram or Twitter and include the hashtag 710 Thank You Thursdays. Every Thursday, we'll interview a frontline worker and award them a $500 thank you gift to include $200 service to Valvoline Instant Oil Change, $100 gift card to WingstopVSLiquor.com and Shooteria.com. So, as always, big thank you to our partners and big thank you to our frontline workers. So, Torrey Hunter, former baseball player, 19 years in the major leagues, played 5 years with 5 years with the Angels, but really the bulk of his career is with the Minnesota Twins, was on ESPN's Golic and Wingo. This was last week. And I want to go back and play a specific clip, his experience, one of the road games. There's one city he felt like on a consistent basis, and it wasn't just this city, but on a consistent basis he felt, there were plenty of times where he was called derogatory terms, racial slurs. Here's Torrey Hunter on ESPN's Golic and Wingo.
Man, it was a tough time. You know, we go there, and I always wanted to play with Boston, and you know, but my first time in 2000, not really my first time, but my first time hearing it was 2000, and I heard it, and I looked up. It was two little boys, you know, saying the N-word, and I told the cop there, I told the parents, I mean, shut them up. And they was like, no. They throw their hands up like, you know, like it's a joke. I'm like, no, you're going to teach those two little boys right now, which from 2000, they might be grown-ups, and they got hate in their heart.
So there's a lot more to it than that. But one of the points that Torrey Hunter was trying to make is, you know, he had a no trade clause. And one of the reasons why he had a no trade clause, or he worked for a no trade clause, because he didn't want to play for the Boston Red Sox. And he talked about how he just felt like, you know, what am I going to do with my family, that experience for my wife or my kids? He didn't want to be put in that position. So this was his experience. This is Torrey Hunter's experience at Fenway Park. So a tweet comes out earlier today, how long ago is this? About 6 hours ago, comes out from the Red Sox official Twitter handle. And it says, this is real. And then it goes into a letter. It's in all black. The words are in white. It says, Torrey Hunter's experience is real. If you doubt him because you've never heard it yourself, take it from us. It happens. Last year, there were 7 reported incidents at Fenway Park where fans used racial slurs. Those are just the ones that we know about. And it's not only players. It happens to the dedicated black employees who work for us on game days. Their uniforms may be different, but their voices and experiences are just as important. We are grateful to everyone who has spoken up and remained committed to using our platform to amplify the many voices who are calling out injustice. I'm reading a tweet here from the Boston Red Sox, not technically responding to Torrey Hunter, but admitting to what Torrey Hunter is mentioning. They go on to say, there are well-established consequences for fans who use racial slurs and hate speech in our venue, and we know we have more work to do. This small group of fans does not represent who we are, but are rather a reflection of a larger systemic issue that as an organization we need to address. True change starts from within, and as we identify how we can do better, please know we are listening, we hear you, and we believe you. And it's got, you know, the Red Sox logo. So this, first of all, caught my eye just listening to Torrey Hunter and listening to his experiences at a ballpark, at Fenway specifically. One of the most, you know, historical fan bases ballparks, Major League Baseball teams there is in baseball. I've been to Fenway. If you've never been there before, unbelievable. Just what an incredible baseball experience. But the fact that that's how they respond to what Torrey Hunter said, you want to talk about taking steps towards change. If that's not a perfect example of admitting we have an issue, pointing out 7 reported incidents, pointing out, take it from us, it happens in our ballpark, that's a freaking big time step. It happens to dedicated Black employees who work for us on game days. I mean, I can't tell you how important this was for not just the Red Sox to send this out, but to give it the proper thought, to put themselves in Torrey Hunter's perspective, to put themselves in Black employees who work there at Fenway Park, to look through their lens. That's how you make change. And I just loved everything about this. I hated the predicament. I hated the situation. Of course, I wish that none of this happened, but it did happen to Torrey Hunter. I'm sure it happens at other ballparks, and I'm sure it happens, you know, everywhere across the country, and I'm not talking just baseball, but that response from the Red Sox, that is a response from an organization that definitely points out that they have an issue, they have a problem, but they want to do something about it. So hats off to Torrey Hunter to telling the story, and, you know, I appreciate and respect what the Red Sox responded with. Now it's a matter of, you know, obviously taking action and making sure any player or employee that's ever in that predicament, you make sure that whoever comes out has some type of a racial slur is banned from Fenway Park. All right, tomorrow Bob Nightingale is going to join the show. Dave McMenamin is going to join the show. Thank you to Jesse. Thank you to Curtis. LA, as always, greatly appreciate you guys tuning in. 6:30 tomorrow. Have a great night.